He's a partner in the San Francisco firm of Zittrain and Mastro Monaco. He has extensive experience as a trial lawyer, from defending murder cases to representing plaintiffs in products liability and sexual harassment lawsuits. Richard Zittrain also teaches law, trial practice, and legal ethics at the University of San Francisco and the University of California's Hastings campus. He is co-author with Carol Langford of The Moral Compass of the American Lawyer: Truth, Justice, Power, and Greed. Questions and comments for our guest, Richard Zittrain, are welcome. In Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside Champaign-Urbana, anywhere in Illinois or Indiana, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. Richard Zittrain, good afternoon, and my apologies for those jokes.
Oh, well, you know, I kind of enjoy lawyer jokes myself, Celeste, so I don't mind them. You know, there are some good reasons for them, as you pointed out. Lawyers are not held in terribly high regard in our society, and perhaps with some good reason.
Yeah. And this is not a new phenomenon. You tell a story in the book about Abraham Lincoln.
Yes.
Defending a man by the name of Duff Armstrong.
Yeah, well, we all learn that, or many of us learn that story of Duff Armstrong in our civics classes, in which Lincoln proved by showing the Almanac to the jury that the witnesses could not have seen Duff Armstrong kill a man because the moon had already set and the people claimed to have seen it by moonlight. But in fact, Armstrong was almost undoubtedly guilty, notwithstanding Lincoln's Almanac trick.
Yeah. So what do we make of Abraham Lincoln's conduct here?
Well, we have written about the criminal defense lawyer and also other lawyers in the civil arena, and we conclude that part of the job of the criminal defense lawyer is to put the state to its proof. So Lincoln did the right thing, but Lincoln isn't doing anything different, or didn't do anything different back then than Johnny Cochran did in the O.J. Simpson case now. And yet, you know, we lionize Lincoln and are very critical of lawyers who, quote-unquote, get guilty people off.
Yeah. Since you mentioned Johnny Cochran, why don't you talk with us just for a bit about how you saw that trial, the O.J. Simpson trial?
Well, there are many facets to the trial, and of course we've kind of beaten it to death by this point. But Mr. Goldman, Ron Goldman's father, asked, you know, is this justice? Or commented, this isn't justice. And it certainly was not justice in his view. But justice for one person isn't always justice for everybody, and for some people who felt that the police officers in that case had not told the truth on the witness stand, for example, by claiming that they didn't consider Simpson to be a suspect, justice prevailed when police officers who were untruthful did not get away with what they wanted, which was a conviction of Simpson. So there are different forms of justice, and I'm not so sure that some measure of justice wasn't done when we take a look at the entirety of the two cases, the criminal trial, in which the prosecution and the cops, I think, performed very poorly, and the civil trial, in which Simpson was found to be liable to the families of the two people who were killed and having to pay more money than he will probably ever earn in the rest of his lifetime. I think the system worked in the Simpson case, although it took many years for it to work. And it's too easy to say, well, we conclude he's guilty from our vantage point thousands of miles away and convict him without the evidence that's being presented to the jury. I think the system worked pretty well in the Simpson case.
Overall, how do you think the justice system is functioning?
Well, we think it works pretty well in criminal cases. Most of the time, in most situations, guilty people are convicted, and we have the highest number of people in prison per capita of any Western country. But in civil cases, where tobacco lawyers buried documents for over 35 years, where collusive settlements occur in class actions and other kinds of cases, where a discovery abuse, that is the exchange of information that takes place between one side and another, continues to be a very unequal and unlevel playing field, we think that a great deal of abuse takes place on a day-in and day-out basis, and that there have to be some significant changes to the system, which we recommend in the concluding chapter of our book.
Yeah. Maybe we can come back to criminal justice, but for a moment maybe we can talk about the civil justice system. You quote Chief Justice Rehnquist in the book on the system of discovery as saying, causing delay and sowing confusion not only are his right, meaning the attorney's right, but maybe his duty.
Right.
But now, for a plaintiff with shallow pockets, this can mean great injustice.
Well, Chief Justice Rehnquist is just flat out wrong about that. That's not what the system is about. And it's distressing to me to read that he thinks that is what the system is about. And I don't know that he would say that out of context of a particular case in which maybe there wasn't so much injustice going on. I mean, if you listen to him give a speech, I doubt very much whether he would adhere to that position. Because it's an untenable position to say that the goal of the civil justice system is to obfuscate the truth and to basically allow those who are more powerful to get away with pulling the wool over the eyes of those who don't have as much power. That's not what our system is about, and I doubt that Rehnquist would stand by that quote if we took it out of the context of the place in which he said it.
Well, maybe you would talk with us just a little bit about, give us some clue as to the context in which he did say that.
Well, I think he said it in the context of a case. And what happens in cases is that the judges give opinions that contain language which is general, and we use it as precedent, as we call it, in other cases, but is fact-specific. That is, it relates to the facts of the particular underlying case. And, you know, that can create an enormous problem when that kind of language is abused. Let me tell you what the best example of it is. We have a term called zealous advocacy. There isn't a law school in the country that doesn't teach about zealous advocacy. There isn't a judge in the country that doesn't understand that lawyers are supposed to act with zealous advocacy. But the reality is that the American Bar Association rules, which govern the behavior of lawyers in almost every state, changed the rules 15 years ago to take the term zealousness out of the rules. Now it's replaced by diligence, competence, hardworking, loyalty. But not zealousness, because zealousness was simply going too far, or zeal was simply going too far. And yet courts continue to apply this standard. And what we've created is what we call, in the moral compass of the American lawyer, what we call the adversary theorem, that it is a polarized me-against-you system with, like, the knights fighting on horses with lances in the Middle Ages, and that's the way it's going to be, and somehow the truth will out. Well, the truth doesn't come out in those circumstances. What happens is that the stronger knight with the stronger horse and more lances and more soldiers behind him or her will out. And so where we think there needs to be some change is in how we interpret this idea of zealous advocacy and in leveling the playing field to provide access to everybody to the legal system, not just the powerful and the rich.
Maybe you would describe for us what you mean by the adversarial theorem, and how did we come to this way of seeking justice?
Well, I think the adversarial theorem is this idea that you and I go against each other, and somehow the best man or woman will win. Truth will out in the process. Truth is always the idea that truth emerges out of this battle is kind of like a, kind of medieval version of trial by fire. And it's archaic. It doesn't work that way. We don't recommend doing away with the system where it is you on behalf of your client against me on behalf of my client. But what we say is we have to turn on the flow of an exchange of information. We have to turn off the ability for the lawyers to collude with each other to work out deals that are good for their individual clients but may hide dangerous products from the rest of society or defective cars from millions of people who drive those cars. That it takes the adversary theorem to an absurd extreme, because the legal system is then used to assist in the concealing of things that are important for society to know.
Mm.
Where did it come from? It came out of the criminal law, because in the criminal law, where we have the Sixth Amendment and the Fifth Amendment and due process of laws and certain rights that go with every criminal defendant that are different than it was in England, which is, after all, the system that our system evolved from, those ideas were applied kind of lock, stock, and barrel across the way to the civil case, and they don't necessarily apply there.
Hmm.
And they shouldn't apply there.
Talk with us about discovery, the process of discovery. What is it?
Well, the process of discovery is when one side, there's a lawsuit. It's Jones versus the Smith Company. And Jones has filed a lawsuit. It may be for anything, but let's say it's for a defective product, that the Smith Company makes a drug that's dangerous or a car that's dangerous. And discovery is the process in which Jones tries to get information about the Smith Company's product in its files. Could be about anything. If it's an accident at an intersection, it might be witness statements or police reports or whatever it is that's relevant to the case. And the Smith Company tries to find out things about Jones. And they do that in a number of ways. First, they can investigate on their own. Second, they can ask questions of the other side. Third, they can ask the other side to produce documents if the documents are relevant, so that if the Smith Company's got a document in its file that says, you know, we know this car is a little bit defective, but what the heck, it would be expensive to fix it. And Jones asks for that kind of document. It's obviously relevant. He ought to get it. And finally, there's a deposition process where you take the sworn testimony of various people connected with the Smith Company. You might take Jones's deposition, Jones's spouse's deposition, any witnesses' depositions, where they're taking sworn testimony before a certified court reporter. So there are a lot of parts of the discovery process, and those are not all of them, but those are perhaps the most important ones.
Yeah. At the very outset of the book, you tell a story of a woman who is just a working woman, and she's been fired from her job unjustly,
right,
in my view, and she wants justice. She takes her employer to court, but the attorney for her former employer makes it really hard for her.
Right.
Saying that, well, we want to depose you, but that will happen at our branch office, which is a train ride and two bus stops.
Right.
From where this woman is, far
right.
away from their main downtown, the law firm's main downtown branch. What do you think
right.
of that? What do you think of that behavior?
Well, I think that it's obvious when we put it in the introduction that we don't like it.
Yeah.
What we've said is that lawyers consider this unethical, but the public considers it pretty abhorrent. And for the public, this is justice denied, not serving the ends of justice, but justice denied. And yet lawyers are taught that if this is what it takes to win for your client, basically making an individual on the other side jump through so many hoops that they drop from exhaustion before they can jump through all of them, then it's not justice being served. And we started with that story, first of all, because it's a true story. We are intimately familiar with. We know the case is a real case in which that happened. And second, because it's the kind of thing which points out this fallacy of the adversary system being placed ahead of everything else. And we wanted to point out that there needs to be more balance between doing everything you possibly can on behalf of your client and also serving the needs of society. So you don't have to do everything imaginable, even if it's technically, quote, within the bounds of the law.
How do you find the right balance? How does a lawyer find the right balance between a proper representation of their client and serving the greater good?
Well, a lot of how you find it is a very personal thing to a particular lawyer. One of the ways we think we've got to help lawyers find it is by starting to work with law students and teaching them that there has to be a moral component to their lawyering, that it is not good enough to say, I can do this because it's ethical, because I can get away with it, that it's not good enough to define what's, quote, ethical as what you can get away with, that ethical ought to mean a standard of behavior that's appropriate and moral and reasonable. And look, I'm a trial lawyer. I try cases, and when I'm in trial, I want to win for my client. But there are certain corners that I'm not prepared to cut for my client, even if he or she may want them, because it's just going too far. I think the first level is that, and we've been doing a lot of this since this book came out, and I know that you're situated on the University of Illinois campus or near the Illinois campus, that our schools, and particularly our law schools, have to start talking about these kinds of things rather than just giving a bunch of plastic rules that are two-dimensional and saying, here, don't break any of them. Also, the system can reform itself. We don't have to have rules that say this. We don't have to continue to bow to the god of zealous advocacy 15 years after the rules took the phrase out. One of the things we've said in the book is, hey, judges, lawyers out there, stop using the phrase zealous advocacy. It's not there anymore. Replace it with diligence, competence, loyalty, and all of those kinds of things, and do those things for your client without going as far as this goes. And we've suggested a bunch of reforms in the last chapter of the book, mm-hmm. which we think will also help change things, to make the rules less ambiguous, to make certain kinds of behaviors unethical by writing a rule that says so, so that some of the worst extremes of behavior that we write about in the book will no longer be so tempting to lawyers to do.
Your recommendations, how are they sitting with folks that are lawyers? What kind of discussions have you had with the law community?
Well, it's interesting. There are a few law schools that have picked up the book and taken a look and said, moral compass of the American lawyer, let's take a look at this, and wound up giving it to their students to read. And there, the reception has been great. I mean, people have, the incoming law students have read it, and we've gone to a couple of law schools where we've talked to students about it and helped teach and workshop the book, and they've said, wow, you know, this is really an eye-opener about what I'm looking at and what I'm looking forward to. We're hopeful that a lot more law schools are going to get interested in using it in that way. And there, the reception has been nothing but positive.
Mm-hmm.
Lawyers, for the most part, the folks that I know, and Carol Langford, my co-author, knows, have been very positive about it as well, because it's a book that wants to reform the system to make it, I think the end result of what we suggest would be to make it more fair to average people as opposed to those who have the most money and the most power. You know, the subtitle of the book is Truth, Justice, Power, and Greed, and we're trying to diminish the power and greed elements and increase the truth and justice elements. But I think, Celeste, that you got a segment of the legal community that's a little bit of afraid of what we're recommending, and would just as soon leave things the way they are. And we knew that would happen, and it doesn't surprise us, and it frankly doesn't bother us. If we weren't shaking some trees here, we wouldn't be doing our jobs.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our guest this afternoon, Richard Zitrin. He and Carol Langford are co-authors of The Moral Compass of the American Lawyer, Truth, Justice, Power, and Greed. They are both practicing attorneys, and they are both teachers. Legal ethics is our topic here today in this monthly discussion on the Afternoon Magazine we call The Law and You. Questions, comments are welcome in Champaign-Urbana. Our number, 333-9455. Anywhere else, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. We have a caller waiting for us on line one in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Thank you. I was listening to a lecture by Camille Paglia last night here at the university, and she was talking about how the on the East Coast there's such an incestuous relationship between publishers and people in the media that they all know each other. They all come from the same schools. And I was thinking, while you were talking, your guest was talking, that it's kind of the way I feel about the lawyers in most American cities. They seem to have such a incestuous relationship amongst themselves and the judges, and seems to me like it comes down on the side of what they consider the the right side of the tracks. That's just a comment, and I've got a couple of questions. One of my I was looking at. I was wondering about. I think I understand the profession pretty well, and I think I understand what its intentions are. But a couple of things make me wonder. One is I was thinking about a quote from Thoreau, and I first thought about this when Clinton was caught on tape saying, "Well, it depends what is means." Thoreau said that for the lawyer, truth is not truth with a capital T, but consistency. And I was wondering if you'd comment on that.
Well, I think that's an interesting point. We actually, when we do our programs with first-year students, start out by talking about truth and justice and what truth and justice mean. And one of the things we talk about, one of the things I ask is, we've got 200 law students in a room, and we're asking, is truth one of the things that you seek to do as a lawyer? And the vast majority of them say, no, it's not. And when we talk to them about why, they say, well, all this truth stuff is relative. And it seems to me that that's some of what you're saying. They're much more likely to see themselves as seekers of justice than they are to see themselves as seekers of truth. And that's kind of an interesting thing. So truth can get lost in the system. But I'm not sure that the system is really designed to find the truth, and I'm not sure that we're going to ever succeed in having a system where truth is the main goal of what we're doing, because there are some truths that we don't want to come into the courtroom, like a confession that's beaten out of a suspect, for example. Do we want that confession to come in, or would we rather just say... No, the confession's not going to come in because it wouldn't be fair to the defendant to allow the confession to come in because the jury might get the wrong impression about how it was beaten out of him. So we use legal fictions all the time, and I'm not so sure that that's a bad thing. But I do think that the total lack of allegiance to truth, where people say, hey, my job is to just do whatever my client wants and to heck with the truth, it takes us a little bit too far down this adversarial road that we worry about.
Yeah. The caller also mentioned his concern that maybe lawyers, judges share too close a relationship.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And, of course, they do share a closer relationship. In the first chapter of the book, which is about a relatively horrific story of two lawyers who found the buried bodies of two girls that their serial killer client had killed and wouldn't tell anybody about them, including the parents of the girls themselves. One of the parents is quoted as saying, when it comes to lawyers against lawyers, it's a pretty close fraternity. I think to a certain extent that's true, but I think that there's enough diversity in the profession and enough checks and balances within the legal profession that, collusive behavior among lawyers that's right out there in the open, or favoritism among judges, among certain kinds of people, generally isn't too extreme. Any group of people that works together is going to get to know each other. And, when you appear in front of a judge all the time, you're going to get a reputation in front of that judge. in my experience, they're able to draw pretty reasonable lines. But on the other hand, there's a lot of truth to what the caller says about the fact that, you know, if you know the judge, if you know the town, if you practice in that town, you're going to have some advantages that somebody coming from somewhere else is not going to have.
I want to thank the caller for his comment and his question this afternoon, and I want to go to another caller waiting for us on line two in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
I wonder if this adversarial mindset might bleed into the attorney's professional firm relationships and maybe even into their personal relationships, and I'd like to hear if that's part of your book. Thank you. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
Well, that is part of it. It's particularly part of it for young associates in large firms, or in any kind of firm, but it's probably more graphic in large firms. You know, law firms have cultures, just like any group of people working together have cultures. And if the culture of the law firm is that you've got to build 2,000 hours a year, no matter what, then you are acculturated in that way. And you, as a 24-year-old, maybe making $90,000 a year in New York or L.A., it can be as much as $112,000 a year. And you're 24 years old, and you got a lot of student loans and debts to pay back. And you're told to cut corners in the way you bill and to bill three clients at the same time and to write the letter that the client wants, even though maybe it's a stretch to take that kind of position. There's an enormous pressure on you to do that. And now we're talking about not just legal work, but personal values, because we're talking about money, we're talking about your behavior around money, we're talking about honesty to yourself, and we're talking about stuff that gets taken home. And it's why lawyers have a high level of alcoholism by all measurements of drug use compared to other professions, of stress-related problems, of divorce and all kinds of things. And it's because that kind of thing gets taken home. It's very, very tough to draw the line at the end of the day. We've written a couple of chapters about that exact situation in the book, and spent a lot of time with law students talking about how to make choices in the beginning of your career so that you're not put in that kind of situation. That's a very good question.
Hmm. How often do lawyers set limits on who they will represent and what they will do for a client?
Good lawyers set limits on that all the time. Some lawyers set limits that really don't have much more to do with anything but money. Here's an example. I'm taking it from the third chapter of the book. When Credit Suisse needed representation because victims of the Holocaust who claimed to have money deposited in Swiss bank accounts that was stolen by the banks were threatening to file actions against them, Wilmer Cutler in D.C., which is Lloyd Cutler's law firm, Lloyd Cutler was Clinton's White House counsel and had previously been White House counsel, I believe, sometime during the Carter administration. I hope I'm not painting Jimmy Carter improperly with that. I think it was in the Carter administration. Is a well-known inside the Beltway lawyer who had successfully represented GM in the 70s, and his main job for GM was getting the national regulatory agencies to push back safety regulations so GM wouldn't have to do it that quickly. But in the 90s, Wilmer Cutler was invited to take on the Credit Suisse case. And there are a lot of law firms that didn't want to do that case. Aaron Fox, another inside the Beltway D.C. firm, simply turned the case down after putting it to a vote of its associates. Wilmer Cutler just took it in as an ordinary new business case and really didn't give any thought to the, or didn't appear to give any thought, I shouldn't say didn't give any, but didn't appear to the outside world to give any thought to the fact that they're representing a bank in stealing assets from Holocaust survivors. Now, you might or might not make a decision to represent the bank. I'd just say no. But if you do make that decision, don't you think it's something that you should bring the associates into the loop on, even if they're not partners in the firm, because they're the ones who are going to have to do the work. And how are they going to feel about it? This goes back to what the caller said about, you know, does it become a personal kind of thing? Well, it does become personal when you're all of a sudden in a law firm and they hand you a file and it's defending Credit Suisse, and you've got to do it because you work at that law firm. So, you know, you have the opportunity to say no. You have the opportunity to say, we're not going to represent these people. But if you simply are looking at the financial well-being of the firm, and law firms are businesses, then the likelihood of doing that goes down substantially.
You mentioned a moment or two ago the case that is that you tell early in the book about a very troubling case, a serial killer, and the cost to that fellow, Armani, who was one of the attorneys, was just, you know, for how you, no matter how you think about, I think that what these two attorneys did was really pretty reprehensible. But I do feel for that fellow, Armani. When is it appropriate for an attorney to step away from a client?
Well, the best time is before you take the client. Maybe we should describe a little bit about what that case is about. Armani, actually, he pronounces the name Armani as opposed to the guy who makes the suits.
Right.
I guess he doesn't make the suits himself, but he sure puts his name on them. But Armani and another lawyer undertook to represent this guy who was accused of one murder, and they suspected of several others. And the guy told Armani where the bodies of two girls were buried, and Armani and his co-counsel actually went out and found the bodies because they wanted to make sure that he wasn't making it up. And they photographed the bodies at some difficulty, and you know, I'll leave it to readers of the first chapter of the book to read the whole story. And I mentioned that we're also working on a screenplay about this story, actually.
Wow.
Because it is such a kind of horrendous example of the tough decisions lawyers have to make. But when he was done doing that, the parents of the kids came to him because they suspected his client, although they couldn't prove it. They didn't have any hard evidence. And they said, can you tell us where the bodies of our daughters are buried? And they refused to say anything. The thing that is compelling about the story is, as you've read, Armani went through hell in making the decision not to say anything. And there are a lot of reasons that had to do with his own personal life that made it particularly difficult for him to say nothing. But I don't think he had any choice. His choice came when he agreed to take the client. And he knew when he agreed to take the client that this was going to be one of those horrendous cases. And so he had the chance to say no and back away from his client then. But once you're in, as the English used to say, you're in for a penny or in for a pound. And you can't get halfway in. You can't put your feet in the waters and back them off again, because once you've agreed to represent them, you've jumped into that stream, and you've got to swim in that stream with your client. And that's what he found himself in the position of doing, much to his own detriment, as it turned out.
Even as reprehensible as the client is, though, he is due a defense.
Well, Armani put it this way. He was asked in a TV interview by Fred Graham, who does a lot of this kind of thing. He says, well, you know, how can you represent a piece of scum like Garrow? And Armani just looks kind of in exasperation. He says, you know, it's very hard to explain it, and it's even harder to justify it, but where do you make the exception? How do you make the exception? He felt that he didn't have the right to make that exception. And, in fact, I think he was right. You get to decide by saying, I'm not going to represent this guy. But once you're there representing him, unless you can withdraw without prejudicing his rights, you're stuck. And you've got to do what is in his best interest, even when it interferes with what's in other people's best interest.
Yeah.
In a criminal case. Oh, now we're talking about in a criminal case. And I think it's a little bit different in civil cases.
There's a case you include from the experience of a criminal law professor, Harry Subin.
Yes, my criminal law professor, and a wonderful guy, still teaching at New York University.
And he's grappled with this issue of how do you represent someone you know is guilty.
Right.
Talk with us about his idea about acting as a monitor in a case for a client.
His idea really comes down to Harry Subin, who ran a criminal law clinic at the NYU for many, many years, isn't going to run that clinic anymore because he can't do what he's required to do as a criminal defense lawyer, because he can't sit by personally and watch someone who's guilty and help that person get off and cross-examine the, as he puts it, the innocent rape victim and argue consent, because he thinks that's the wrong thing to do. And while he argues that there should be this monitoring function, that the lawyer stops becoming an advocate and actually becomes a monitor, the reality of that situation is that Professor Subin doesn't run that clinic anymore because he's made the choice not to put himself in those circumstances. You know, it's a little bit different when it's a civil case and when you're representing the tobacco companies and they come to you and say, hide these documents, because we're not dealing with the constitutional issues. We're not dealing with a state that has to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And the problem with Professor Subin's analysis is that Harry wants to be a monitor, but that doesn't do what a criminal lawyer's sworn duty is to do, and that is to put the state to its proof beyond a reasonable doubt. I was up in Wisconsin a few weeks ago in Milwaukee doing a talk before the State Criminal Defense Lawyers Conference, and they have to do these continuing education programs. And one of them came up to me afterwards and said, you know, it's hard for people to understand, but when they say, how can you represent somebody who's guilty? I'm not representing somebody who's guilty. I represent someone who may have done it, but they're not guilty until the jury comes back and says so. And that may be a fine distinction, but it's an important one, because we have to put the state to its proof. And in fact, the people who do that don't represent people who are guilty. They may be representing people who did it, but they're not guilty until the state has proven it by evidence. And the irony of it is that the person we quote who's most eloquent about that is Justice White, who was a relatively conservative Supreme Court judge who very eloquently talked about how the criminal justice lawyer's duty is not to the truth but to some other goal, to put the state's case in the worst possible light, he said, regardless of what he thinks or knows to be the truth. So it's not for everybody, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And it's not for Harry Subin anymore, and he doesn't do that anymore.
Yeah. In civil cases, how often is justice subverted?
Well, how often?
Is it a,
it's a daily occurrence.
Yeah.
I think it happens hundreds of times a day in hundreds of courtrooms. We only see the tip of the iceberg. We've written about the Dear Doctor letter. I don't know whether you read that portion of the book, but maybe I could. It's a brief story. Maybe I could tell it because I think it's an example of the way the civil justice system works.
Okay.
A law firm in Seattle named Bogle and Gates was representing a drug company, and there was a little girl who was poisoned by this drug because she had an allergic reaction to the drug, which was called, which was a form of theophylline, and she was asked, or the drug company was asked by her and by her pediatrician, who was also involved in the suit, to give them any, quote, dear doctor letters that related to bad effects of this drug. And the law firm gave them nothing. And years later, someone gave the pediatrician's lawyer anonymously a copy of a dear doctor letter. Said, dear doctor so-and-so, there's a problem with allergic reactions with certain kids to this drug. And instead of just copping to it, the law firm defended itself and said, well, we didn't know that by quote, dear doctor letters, we didn't know that they meant any dear doctor letter. We thought that the request was, and this is what they said, quote, a term of art referring to a warning letter mailed at the FDA's request to all physicians, not just any old dear doctor letter. And they got 14 ethics experts from all across the country to support the view that they didn't have to give up that letter and they were right not to do it.
Mm.
Well, they got caught because someone dropped that letter on the pediatrician's lawyer. And when the case got to the state Supreme Court, the court decided 7-0 not only that that defense was ludicrous, but that they should have given the letter. And if they didn't give up the letter, there'd never be a question you could ever ask in the discovery process that would produce that letter. But the point is that that kind of thing is not the exception. That's happening all the time. It's just that this particular firm got caught. And that's what we mean by taking zealous advocacy too far. Because that's just going beyond what any lawyer should be doing in defense of a client.
It's right off the cliff.
Right.
So what can be done about these kinds of abuses in civil law?
Well, we have to stop using the term zealous advocacy. We have to start applying the rules that prevent misrepresentations and prevent lying. Lying should be deemed to be lying, not what's called now in the rules material misrepresentations. We've written about how by material it means, you know, is it substantial and relevant to the case? Would it come in as evidence in the case? But there are a lot of misrepresentations that lawyers can argue aren't quote-unquote material because they wouldn't come into evidence in the case that are really more important than those that are. We have to stop playing semantic subterfuges with the way in which we apply rules. We have to start saying, if it's not truthful, you can't do it. If it's a misrepresentation, with certain particular exceptions, such as negotiating a case, which is kind of inherently deceptive, with certain very specific exceptions, you can't do it. And instead of having rules that leave so much wiggle room, that what we've got is a bunch of lawyers figuring out what the exceptions to the rules are, instead of how to follow the rules that exist. And then ultimately, lawyers have to involve the public more in the process, involve the public more in their institutions, such as the American Bar Association, and also take personal responsibility for their actions. You know, law schools teach that you can be a lawyer under one set of rules and then kind of take off your lawyer hat and put on your human being hat at the end of the day. Real life doesn't work that way. We wear both hats all the time, and the human being hat never leaves our heads.
Mm.
And so lawyers have to take more personal responsibility in their personal behavior, and part of the reason for our writing the book is to encourage them to do so.
We're out of time. Thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you. That was a very fast...
Lawyer, Truth, Justice, Power, and Greed. It's published by Ballantine Books.